those two deputies from contact with detainees and is investigating
internally. So, but we won't know what the outcome of that is unless someone actually asks, right? Because they don't publicize any internal personnel reviews, I suspect.
We have asked for a response. We haven't gotten one yet. And we did ask that an independent body conduct the investigation, but that is not happening.
Yeah, that's key, because how do you have people investigating their colleagues and then expect that it would be an impartial investigation? We've got callers stacked up, so we're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Carol. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Thank you so much. I am absolutely loving your show.
Thank you.
I am both a mental health provider and also the sister of someone with severe schizoaffective disorder who's been homeless and been in contact off and on for very minor issues related to mental illness and incarcerated. And I just am loving the comments that you're making. Two quick ones and a comment about one is when people present with an authoritarian, threatening manner, everyone can read that, especially people with limited language skills, mental illness, or dementia, which it's interesting. People will read your affect through your body. And so that, I hope, is part of the eventual training that people get. But the other thing I wanted to comment and is that if we can create a society where people's initial contacts are kind and supportive, we will prevent an entire second very severe diagnosis, which most chronically mentally ill people have to some degree, I think. I defer to the expertise of the guest. But that is preventing post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of contacts with law enforcement or mental health facilities. And that's a second disorder that's hard to treat because it takes a long time and they have to be safe to do it. So that was my comment. I'd love to hear a response.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your call.
Thank you.
So I think an important point that I'd like to make is that when we talk about investing in community services, we really need buy-in and input from people who are directly affected, from consumers of mental health services, because there is a history of trauma and fear around, both hospitals and jails. And I think that it's really important that we're asking people, what do you need? What works for you? What services would you be willing to accept? And most of the time, the answer is peer-delivered services. So, you know, where you're in an environment where you feel safe, where you feel a sense of trust, and where someone who's kind of been through what you've been through is walking you through it. And I think that's really key.
That's the ideal, right? Back to the phone line. Good morning, Jackie. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just want to make a comment. I really appreciate what everyone is saying this morning. And I want to note that in any field, there are people who are problematic, who don't have great skills.
Right.
I personally am in the mental health field. I've worked with police and the jail, both jails, and I do want to comment that there are some amazing sheriffs, there are some amazing police. They're doing a lot of work right now to approach folks with mental illness in a kinder, gentler way. And
Where do they work?
For Portland Police and Multnomah County Jail.
Ah, okay.
I've had many personal experiences, and I know that Portland Police are doing a lot of work to train their officers, and I've worked personally with them and mental health clients, and I just want to say that there are some really good folks out there.
Yeah, I don't doubt that there's a some folks who really genuinely get the need to treat people humanely. But as we are talking about, and as this report says, and if you've been following the series in the Portland Tribune, what you know is that intention really doesn't matter. It is the outcomes. And the outcomes say that we are failing miserably. People with mental health issues, people of color, throughout our justice system. So it doesn't matter that we have a couple of good people that are trying to do the right thing if the system is flawed. And the system is terribly flawed.
I understand your point of view, and I'm offering an observation that the system is working to change and become better, and the outcomes are better. So that's all I want.
I appreciate your call. But again, 2010 was James Chassie, and we're still having the same conversation about how we treat people with mental health issues in our county jail. So how can the system be better if we're still treating people the exact same way? I just need an answer to that, because I'm sorry, I can't trust that we're doing better when the outcomes are absolutely horrible and they haven't changed at all. So maybe we've saved a couple of people because, you know, we've got a couple of officers that know what to do and how to do it. But we need the system to change, not just a couple of officers. We need the fundamental system to change. And the system of accountability is absent. And we need an accountability system. So thank you for your call. Did you want to make any comments, Sarah?
Sure. So I've also met a lot of good people who are working in this system who are trying the best that they can despite the constraints around them. And it's really not about good people or bad people. Right. It's about, like Joanne said, it's about outcomes. It's about, you know, just kind of the reality. And I think that's, you know, the way I try to deflect the defensiveness when we come in and say, look, this is what people are experiencing in your setting.
Right.
This is really concerning. You know, often the response that I get is, we went into the helping profession. Our intentions, you know, are good. We want to help people, but we have to get past that because those good intentions are not
working.
Fixing the problem.
That's
and it's not enough.
Right.
We need systemic change.
Yes. We're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Casey. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for the commentary today.
You're welcome.
I just had two quick questions for Sarah. One had to do with the frequency of mentally ill people on the street. I mean, this is obviously just anecdotal on my part, but I've lived in Portland for 30 years. When I get on light rail in the morning, within three stops, I see at least one to three mentally ill people right away.
Yep.
But my second question has to do with some other variables on the mentally ill issue, and that has to do with drug use. I've been in the medical profession all my life, and there's a disease, hypertension and diabetes, when they're combined, they're much more deadly than they are in isolated fashion. And when you have a mentally ill person taking drugs, I would think that that's a very similar episode that occurs. Can we do anything to stop the amount of people, mentally ill people, who are being fed and sold drugs on the street on a regular basis? And is this, in fact, a severe problem that compounds itself?
Yeah. So in our county, we don't have enough dual diagnosis treatment resources. So for people who have a mental illness and a substance abuse issue, the treatment possibilities are really, really narrow. What we've been told, you know, I talk with the people who, for the county health department or county mental health, who do forensic diversion, so trying to get people out of the jail and into community providers. And what they say is there is just no option for someone who has a substance abuse issue and mental illness.
Wow. And we know that there's a lot of dual diagnoses that could be made on patients. And of course, people who are suffering from mental health illness sometimes self-medicate, which is, I believe, what the caller is referring to, because they're not actually getting any kind of help or medication to assist them in getting better, right?
Yeah, definitely. There's also a dorm at the Inverness Jail that's mm-hmm. a treatment readiness dorm, mm-hmm. so where people can go and, you know, start their outpatient drug and alcohol treatment and then transition from the jail into treatment. And mm-hmm. that dorm is effectively closed to people who have a mental health diagnosis.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, and the jail says that that's because the outside community providers don't accept people with mental illness. But yeah, it raises a lot of disability discrimination concerns.
Yes, it does. And it, you would think being under Department of Justice review would actually propel us to be more creative in fixing this problem.
Mm-hmm.
We've got callers stacked up again, so back to the phone line. Good morning, Francis. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hi. I was just going to mention what your last caller brought up. And also, I understand that those outpatient facilities or inpatient facilities don't take people who have been diagnosed or designated as having any kind of a sex offense.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, so that eliminates a whole lot of people from access to the drug treatment. But my concern was what one of your previous callers just touched on. A lot of people end up having PTSD
right.
as a result of their experience in these institutions.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And is anything being done to address that directly? The harm that is caused by simply incarcerating people in these inhumane conditions.
Well, I think one of, you know, the focus of our report and recommendations is jail is traumatizing. Jail will always be traumatizing. Yes, we should improve training. We should improve practices to make them more trauma-informed. But really, we need to stop arresting people with mental illness and stop sending them to jail.
What about people who don't have mental illness, who become mm-hmm. mentally ill as a result of that experience? Is that being addressed at all?
Mm-hmm.
No. No, we're not. I mean, I don't know. We're not. Nobody's looking at that yet, right? We still have a sheriff's department that basically thinks they're not doing anything wrong, right? That we, you know, everything's fine here.
That it's okay to treat people the way they're.
Exactly, right. Because we've got that paramilitary mindset inside the jails.
All right.
What I can suggest.
That's something that PTSD is very serious.
Call your county. Call your county commissioners and tell them that you care about the human rights of people in jail. You know, I think we need to start and read the report and know the reality in there and tell your elected officials that you care about this issue.
That. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, that's all right. That's a
Thank
great
you for
idea.
Thank you. Appreciate
you, Francis.
Take care.
You too. I think that's absolutely right. You got to call the entire county commission mm-hmm. and say, what are you going to do to fix this, right? Mm-hmm. Because we can't just keep doing reports after reports after reports that tell us the exact same thing, right? And have the sheriff scratching their head like, well, I don't know why that report's so bad. we're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Chris. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Yes, hello. My name is Chris, and I was up in Portland the year that James Chassie died, and I felt very deeply for that situation. I've seen police interact with people with mental health problems here. Extremely good, you know, they're well-trained, they help. But we need to bring this down to a lower, more fundamental level, because the police should not be the point people deal with the failure of the entire system.
Exactly.
And there is a solution. There's a huge solution that we are just sitting on, and I need to refer people to this. There's a neuroscientist, William Walsh. There's a wonderful orthomolecular or nutritional medical doctor, Abram Hoffer, who have pioneered in using a humane, healthy, nutritional, understanding, scientific approach and have huge success with people, 80 to 90% recovery. Now, I want to mention one or two studies. The National Institute of Mental Health did a study between 1975 and 83 where they were looking at people who came from similar situations and looking at people who were given medications versus people who dealt with their situations without medications. And the recovery rate for people without using the drugs was 40% versus only 5% for people that were put on medications. And they find there's a point where people's situations kind of bifurcate, and the people that are able to or not, you know, counseled to take medications have an upturn, like I think it's between, you know, several months and 6 months or so, whereas other people, see, these drugs are degenerative, the actual issues, which actually have been identified. And if people want to find out about this, this is a game changer in this entire field. It's what we've been waiting for thousands of years, and it's a book called Nutrient Power. Heal Your Biochemistry, heal your Brain, Heal Your Life by William Walsh. Because, for example...
I'm sorry, sir. We're not going to have a lot of time to go into William Walsh's philosophy. It's kind of off point of where we are, but you did give people information about how to find more information. Do you have a website or something you want to refer people to?
You can just Google his name. I think he has a website. But you see, the police, they're not the people that should be dealing with the failure. These are exacerbated situations from the start. They can be better trained. We need to do that. The whole society needs to be involved. And, you know, in my community, people are compassionate. I see it all the time. The situation is changing. Help from the medical people by using a friendly, you know, appropriate approach with nutrition, which actually works very, very well, and much better harsh, foreign, unnatural chemicals.
Well, thank you very much for your call. We're going to have to move on. Have a great day.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any comment? You want me to go to the next caller?
Sure. I will say, you know, a lot of the people that I work with do object to medications and do feel, you know, that they're, you know, rightly so, they feel that their personal autonomy has been violated when these serious psychotropic drugs are forced on them. And there are really serious side effects that should be considered.
Right.
And I think one of the doctors that I quote in the report refers to a softly magical thinking around the power of medications.
Right.
It's not always the be-all, end-all.
No.
And it's, you know, we need to look at more holistic care and not just forcing medications on people as the ultimate solution.
Well, and of course, our current healthcare system, everything is drugs, right? And you just try this pill, that doesn't work, don't worry, come back next month, we'll give you another pill, that doesn't work, we'll try another pill, right? We're a pill-driven society based on our healthcare model. Back to the phone line. Good morning, Edie. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. I like to offer different ways of looking at mental illness. Police job description, hiring, supervision, training, accountability. One way is just to look at mental illness as symptoms and behaviors that indicate somebody is suffering.
Yes.
And that we have different ways of handling our pain and our fear. And instead of psychologizing and vilifying it and criminalizing it, see our common humanity and address the causes of the pain and suffering. I would think that police brutality and homelessness and a system that's out to get you no matter what you do, Catch-22, would have someone naturally have post-traumatic stress.
Right.
And wanting to deal with that, reach out to human beings for comfort, and if those people are harmful, that one would want to withdraw. And deaden that, our society says, you deaden it with drugs, with food, with opportunities that people don't have money cannot do.
Yes.
So I would, you know, challenge our whole advertising for drugs on television and our whole approach to health as a way to oppress and control populations when it comes to police. I really don't think we need police, but if we're going to be looking at police, having a job not be about occupied military control over protesters and workers, but instead providing the sense of safety, belonging, and caring and empathy. So the training should not be this super expensive military surveillance, where they're the enemy and bringing in folks that have, when they're scared, they kill and then they drop off folks, you know, toy guns on the scene as an excuse to kill someone like they did in Iraq. What we need is coming out to PCC, PSU, to, you know, church settings and public school settings, in which we can all see the training. And it's training in nonviolent communication and compassionate listening and emotional self-control and dialectical behavior therapy for the police themselves, and having police work in the communities and have commitment in the communities, and that we have more control over the guns and we have more control over them instead of this outrageous police policing themselves, where the good cops have their records washed and they don't get a
promotion.
Benefit from it, and the bad cops get away with it.
I want to thank you very much. I'm going to have to stop you right there because we are out of time, but I can't imagine a better way to end. I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much. And Sarah, it's been such a pleasure. I told you this hour would go by very quickly.
It did.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your research. Your research will save lives. And it's my hope that our elected leaders will actually make something happen because they can't pretend they don't know now. And so thank you so much for being here. And you've been listening to Voices from the Edge. And we'll see you next week. Same time, same place, same station. Have a great day.
Thanks.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good morning. It's 8:58 and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, Press Watch at 9 o'clock in just a couple of minutes, your weekly counter-propaganda left opinion program with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, it's Dennis Bernstein bringing you news and headlines. Also at 11, Between the Covers welcomes author Kathy Camper and her series Lowriders to the Center of the Earth, about a trio of friends who experience out-of-this-world adventures in their quest to build the most epic lowrider. At 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, an encore presentation of Renters' Rights Comics, an informational comic with an aim to educate renters. And all of this great programming because of KBOO members and your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. It's 8:59. Press Watch next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Action Plan, Immigration Rights, on Sunday, March 19th at the Concordia University Library in Portland. Oregon Action Plan is a series of events to inform and empower our community. This first event will focus on immigration in Oregon. How is what's happening on the national level affecting people in Oregon? What are organizations doing to support and protect their communities? And what can allies do to be effective and supportive? Again, that's Oregon Action Plan, Immigration Rights, on Sunday, March 19th at the Concordia University Library, 2800 Northeast Liberty Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids.